This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with People Magazine senior editor Alicia Dennis of New Orleans. She has a major feature coming on the crimes of fashion. Also on the show, Jeff Dorson, the executive director of the Humane Society of Louisiana, on lenient sentences given out to people who are abusive of animals, including a man who killed a champion racehorse, Dr. Drip. Gary Chambers of the Rouge Collection on the battle to succeed Buddy Amoroso, the late councilman who died 2 weeks ago tomorrow. There is, of course, a major controversy about who takes his place, with his wife, his widow Denise, wanting the seat. Also, Kurt Smith, accomplished journalist on the history of presidents and baseball. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757, anywhere you may be. If you're in the Baton Rouge dialing area, you can save a few digits and dial 297-5633. And our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. We begin with Alicia Dennis. She is a New Orleanian and senior editor of People Magazine. And it is a pleasure to share the microphone with you, Alicia. Good morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, People Magazine is, of course, involved in many items as far as journalism and covering people around the country in all facets of life. And in this case, you're covering people who have died. It's an investigation into the crimes of fashion, particularly some notable fashion icons who died violently and mysteriously.
That's completely right. We've delved into cases, I think, that maybe you have heard of some of them, maybe you haven't, and some others, but they all have the similar thread of involving the fashion industry, fashion moguls or icons, and definitely being twisted and interesting plots within these investigations.
Let's start with Versace. This was one that happened in 1997. Hard to believe it's been 21 years, but I remember it well with this guy, Andrew Cunanan, on the loose, and he nailed Versace in the Miami area. What happened?
Yeah, it was one of those shocking crimes that really horrified the world. You have this fashion designer, this mogul, Gianni Versace, who was really at the pinnacle of his career. He had just come away from a very successful show where he had revealed his latest line. He was doing very well and was going to spend some time in Miami where he liked to relax and he liked to have some kind of normalcy in his life. He would go and walk to a local cafe to get coffee. He'd go to a newsstand to pick up magazines, and he was doing just that on the morning when his path crossed with this deranged serial killer, Andrew Cunanan, who was on a murder spree at the time, and took Versace's life right on the steps of his mansion as he was going back inside. It's really a horrific crime, and we look at this investigation from the beginning.
Was this just him being in the wrong place at the wrong time?
You know, it seems that there was some element of that, certainly. Andrew Cunanan was someone who was very charismatic. He was a con man who made up all kinds of fabulous stories about his life, and he told people close to him that he knew Versace, that he, you know, moved around in the same circles that Versace did. That was never proven. That was never, you know, no one really could say that that was true. It was certainly true that Andrew Cunanan wanted the life that Versace had. And it's very possible that he followed and targeted Versace, but because Andrew Cunanan took his own life as police were closing in on him, we'll never really know whether or not he just happened to be in the right place at the right time to take Versace's life, or if this had been something that he had spent weeks planning.
Well, you focus also on a couple of 1995 murders, including that of Lisa Sobeck. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, the case of Linda Sobeck, she was a model who was working hard to break into the life of Hollywood, where she had done a little bit of acting, but she had a huge audition for a television series. It was a callback for her. It was something that could have really taken her career to a whole new level. And, you know, she was doing what a lot of actresses and models do. She's taking an important job, and it took her to the Angeles National Forest, where she never returned. So I think it's a really interesting case, and one that has a lot of warning in it for people that I think she just trusted the wrong person in the industry, and it cost her her life.
Linda Sobeck was all of 27, former NFL cheerleader, and it is a story that is fascinating, as is another 1995 incident, this one in Milan involving Gucci. What happened there?
Yeah, this is a case that I don't know that people knew a lot about. Maurizio Gucci was the head of the Gucci empire. He had gone through a lot of backbiting and craziness within the Gucci dynasty to take over, and had then lost control. Control was wrested away from him, and he was then embarking on a new career. He was looking into setting up casinos and some resort towns in Switzerland when he was targeted by a hitman as he went into his office in Milan. And so as investigators began to try to peel back the layers of what was going on in his life at the time, they were really surprised to discover how many people around him had a reason to want him dead. And so it was an investigation that took over 2 years to come to any kind of conclusion or arrest.
We're talking with Alicia Dennis. She's senior editor of People Magazine, and this is part of the Discovery series, People Magazine Investigates Crimes of Fashion, premiering this coming Monday. And each episode of Crimes of Fashion will explore high-end fashion icons and their crimes that captured headlines. Now, how does a lady from New Orleans like you end up becoming senior editor of People Magazine? What's your odyssey, Alicia?
New Orleans was a wonderful place to grow up, and certainly a place where a lot of news happens all the time. And having had that experience of getting to cover some news there, it was just really a natural progression to be able to get involved in working with People Magazine, which tells really the stories of people all around the country, as you'd mentioned before, not only celebrities, but everyday people doing extraordinary things or people that are caught up in extraordinary circumstances. And so it was exciting to me to get to work for the magazine. I worked in all the different sections within it, not just crime. And about 3-4 years ago, I really delved into the crime section, where we're seeing a lot of ability for us to share these stories, not only in the magazine, but also in these television series that are giving us the opportunity to go into these investigations in an entirely new way, and I think have viewers really experience them differently.
Well, as mentioned, it premieres 8 o'clock Central Monday night. People Magazine Investigates Crimes of Fashion, and people as a whole are fascinated about beautiful people, and you have that, and about these kinds of sordid crimes. It's something that we just can't resist hearing and watching and finding more about.
I think that's true, and I think that, you know, when we look at the lives of these people, you see a lot of glamour, you see a lot of money and luxury, and they seem to have enviable lives. And I think these particular cases show that there's a lot of darkness and murder and greed involved in some of that as well.
Well, congratulations on your fabulous success, senior editor of People Magazine, Alicia Dennis. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on your work. And once again, Monday night, 8 o'clock, Discovery Channel, Crimes of Fashion. Yesterday, the embattled FBI agent who oversaw the opening of the Russia investigation mounted an aggressive defense of himself and the FBI, rejecting accusations that he let his private political views bias his official actions and labeling Republicans' preoccupation with him another victory notch in Putin's belt. This was Peter Strzok, a 26-year veteran who is certainly a target, and that was certainly made apparent by the interrogation he received from the congressman from Pittsburgh, Texas, Louis Gohmert, who took aim not only at Strzok's actions as an FBI agent, but even went into his personal life.
You've embarrassed them, you've embarrassed yourself, and I can't help but wonder, when I see you looking there with a little smirk, how many times did you look so innocent into your wife's eye and lie to her about Lisa?
Mr. Chairman, this is outrageous.
The credibility of a witness is always an issue. Mr. Chairman, this is intolerable harassment
of the witness.
What's wrong with that? You need your medication.
This went on for about 10 hours. And Strzok held his own, and it is interesting that the congressmen like Gohmert, who are fascinated with Strzok's extramarital liaisons, have said nothing about President Trump, who through three marriages has had numerous extramarital affairs, including one with the porn star Stormy Daniels, the former Stephanie Clifford of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It is curious why, to this point, I haven't heard Senator Kennedy or Senator Cassidy or Congressman Graves or Higgins or any of the others representing us on Capitol Hill. Where's Congressman Johnson, who's a big moral crusader, talking about the president and the porn star? But they'll take aim at an FBI agent. We'll be back after this pause with more on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Again, your numbers are 877-217-5757 and 297-5633. We're visiting with Jeff Dorson now. He is the executive director of the Humane Society of Louisiana. We're going to talk with him about a few things in our state, but the most recent incident that Jeff has stepped up to talk about involves an Opelousas man convicted of cruelty in the case of Dr. Drip, a champion racehorse. He was 13 when he had to be euthanized. Germaine Doucet, 19, was convicted of aggravated cruelty to animals. The judge sentenced him to 1 year in prison but suspended it and 1 year of active supervised probation. He could have been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Dr. Drip was found in an Opelousas field so weak he couldn't stand, emaciated and covered with sores. He was euthanized after veterinarians determined his condition warranted the action. What's your take, Jeff Dorson, on these lenient sentences that are handed out to people who sometimes are convicted of heinous crimes against animals?
It's creating an enormous problem, Jim, in our industry, and the industry is animal welfare. I've been lobbying and investigating cruelty for the past 30 years, and something's happening in our court system, in our judicial system, where this has now become commonplace, that people who commit terrible, heinous crimes like you just described, Dr. Drip, are not having any kind of deterrent or penalty. And so it's sending out a terrible message that animal cruelty is almost allowed in our community because there'll be no punishment. And so it's making our job that much harder. The public is outraged, and the country is horrified at what Louisiana is doing to those who abuse animals.
Well, why would a judge go lenient on somebody? It appears there is a distinction made, perhaps wrongly, but there is a distinction made between a crime on an animal and a crime on a person. Do you think that's fair, or is that something that is inappropriate?
I wish the judge would speak for himself and defend his actions because he's been silent. We've been asking people to communicate with him all week, and we'll continue to. In fact, we're going to have a peaceful demonstration because that's what change will take. We have to actually come out, stop what we're doing, and demand change. And that will happen next week in front of his courthouse to let him know that we're so disappointed in his conduct. We consider it negligent, not performing his judicial duties. He went way below, as you already described, the prescribed guidelines the state legislature decided that this was a good level of punishment. No less than 1 year, no more than 10, no less than $5,000, no more than $25,000. That's exactly what how the law reads and why Judge Harris and others are going way below is something that we can't understand.
Where will your demonstration be?
It will be in Opelousas in front of Judge Alonzo Harris's courthouse.
Now, I mentioned Dr. Drip was found in terrible condition. What happened with this champion racehorse and the person who was convicted of mistreating him?
Racehorses in Louisiana and across the country have a difficult life ahead of them once they're retired. They're passed from person to person in rapid succession, or they're sale barns for slaughter. So we see a lot of racehorses at sale barns, former racehorses, and some of them are great champions, but there's no place. People aren't kind to them. They don't remember what of service they were. And so they end up in terrible condition. And this young man, 18, got this horse in bad shape and continued to keep it in bad shape. Jim, you forgot to mention a horrible part of this. The veterinarian called me on the phone saying that he saw and heard maggots eating the flesh and bone of poor Dr. Drip. His hindquarters were full of maggots from open, untreated lacerations and wounds. So imagine all that happening concurrently, simultaneously to this poor horse. I can't imagine, you know, what else constitutes torture than that, being eaten alive.
All right, and how was this 19-year-old man involved in the mistreatment?
He failed to take any action. He knew about it. Obviously, he saw it. He actually rode poor Dr. Drip in that condition, and that's how a neighbor saw it.
Oh, my.
So he, yeah. So the part of the law is failure to act. By the very omission of a failure to keep it healthy and happy and under veterinary care is a crime in itself.
Well, there are some other examples, aren't there, of recent cases of mistreatment and death of animals in which the convicted people got lenient sentences in other parts of our state.
Yep, Bastrop, Louisiana, just last month, two men, one of which slit the throat of a peaceful family pit bull pet. The other one filmed it and put it online. The dog drowned from its own blood. The judge, once more, passed down a sentence that did not include any jail time, a small sentence and very little community service. We're outraged by this.
Was this this was on Facebook, wasn't it?
I think so, or Snapchat. Yeah, but they did get a screenshot of the actual video. It was shared widely. It was horrific. Slitting the throat of a nice, friendly dog that comes up to you wagging. I don't understand the motivation for people. I don't understand these lenient sentences. It's no deterrent. So we're also going to talk to the DA, but he's been reluctant to speak about this, too. There's still something called a motion to reconsider that we're going to ask the DA, and he's been difficult. I have to tell you, he's not sympathetic to this cause, but we're going to urge him, beg him, and protest in front of his office as well to file something called a motion to reconsider to go before the same judge, Alonzo Harris, and ask for a new sentence. We have 30 days to get it done, so the clock is ticking. But if you could reach out to the DA, that would be an interesting interview.
All right. What about other states? Are they more interested in prosecuting and perhaps incarcerating people who are injurious to animals, or is this a nationwide problem?
It's a good question. I don't have the statistics in front of me. I'm seeing success in some states and failures in others. The southern states seem to be lagging. They're hesitant to incarcerate, to impose financial penalties, so it looks like it's a more southern, it's becoming a new southern tradition of allowing, of looking the other way, of being disinterested. And it's terrifying, Jim, because I'm the one that gets the phone calls on these crimes, typically, and then I have to work with police. There's an enormous effort to get them even to get to trial. Evidence.
All right, Dan downtown has been waiting patiently. Dan, I want to get you in with Jeff Dorson, President or Executive Director of the Humane Society of Louisiana. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Given the money being poured into judicial elections, and the sparring we witness on C-SPAN as to appointed federal judges, does it seem that the judicial system has become part and parcel of the U.S. going from democracy to a plutocracy?
That's a larger question, but judges are political animals, and we live in a state, Jeff, that just a few years ago was allowing cockfighting.
Right. We're the last state to allow it. You're so right. Only about 9 or 10 years ago, it was out in the open.
What about this black bear that was found in the backyard of a family in Central? This is an amazing story, isn't it?
Well, fill in. Was that the one that they actually shot? Or
no,
was this
no,
a different
no,
one?
No. They found a black bear. They were able to tranquilize him and transport him to his native habitat in North Louisiana, but he was found in the backyard in Central Louisiana. So that's a good story. But it's your job to focus upon these kinds of things like Dr. Drip. And what can be done to change this?
Follow us on Facebook. We're the ones who we're the change agent, as it were. We're leading the charge. We want a nicer, kinder, more compassionate state. So go on Facebook. We update it virtually every day on cases, campaigns, advocacy, Humane Society of Louisiana. Donate, volunteer, get involved, get engaged, demand change, and do acts of kindness. That's the nicest thing we can all do. Be considerate, be kind, go out of your way, take in a stray, go volunteer at your shelter. Do something so that it increases the level of kindness that we have in this state.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you. I'm sure we'll have occasion to talk again soon. Jeff Dorson.
And, my pleasure. Thanks,
luck,
Jim.
With what you're doing and that vision of Dr. Drip with maggots and a man riding him, it's an amazing story. We'll talk about more when we return. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And Gary Chambers, the editor and publisher of the Rouge Collection, is with us. And next Thursday, the 19th, there will be a council meeting. Usually they're on Wednesdays, but this one will be on Thursday. And presumably a successor to Buddy Amoroso, the councilman, who was a good man, by the way. He died 2 weeks ago tomorrow in a bicycling accident in St. Francisville. And it was thought that his widow, Denise Amoroso, would take his place on the council, and that still may very well be the case. But there are four Democrats who are challenging this, and if they could have gotten the fifth Democrat, Tara Wicker, to join them, they could have blocked Denise Amoroso from taking the seat, and that would have meant Governor Edwards, who is a Democrat, would be allowed to appoint a successor until a special election next March. And it's caused a lot of hostility, as you can imagine, and controversy, something not new to the Metro Council. And Gary Chambers has been following it every step of the way. What's your take on this, Gary?
Well, thank you for having me, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity to have a conversation about this. And I agree with you. Buddy Amoroso was a good man. He and I disagreed often politically, but we had great conversations, went to lunch two or three times a year, every year, so that we could just talk about things that were going on in Baton Rouge. And I do believe that it is a loss to his constituency that he is gone away from us. But this matter of an appointment to the Metro Council, Jim, I have opposed legacy appointments since 2016. I don't know if many folks remember this, but when the late councilwoman, the late state representative, Ronnie Edwards, was a council member and got elected to the legislature in 2015, she made a recommendation to appoint Erica Green in her stead. I challenged Erica Green for that position because I believe that legacy appointments, which is what this is, appointing a widow is a legacy appointment. I think that they give an unfair advantage to the person who is getting into the race to change the democratic process. That's number one. Number two, I think that we must be honest and realistic about this. People are saying there's a time to put politics aside, but the truth is this is a political appointment, nothing else. It is a vacant position and a political appointment. And And I do not believe that we should appoint someone to anybody, not the Metro Council, not the legislature, not the governor's office, not a board or commission, simply because they are the widow or of the previous person who held the seat. We need to know what are the positions of the individual that is serving. And anybody that's married understands that husband and wife don't always agree. I mean, teeth and tongue fall out, Jim. You know, and so the truth is, we don't know, and this is not and it's hard to talk about this because you attempt to be sensitive to the understanding that a wife is grieving her husband, but also understanding that is an individual family situation. And this is talking about the people's seat. And so when you're talking about the people's seat, I think that these council members are exercising a right that the late Buddy Amoroso exercised in 2016.
Yeah, he wanted somebody else to replace Denise Marcel.
Correct. So in January 13, 2016, the same council member where I challenged Erica Green, where John Delgado nominated me, Ryan Hicks supported my nomination. Erica Green got 7 votes. She got appointed to the council. Buddy Amoroso nominated a man named Sandy Lemoyne, who was a white Republican, to replace Denise Marcel, who was a black Democrat in the majority Democratic district. And Buddy Amoroso did this. There was not a newspaper article criticizing him. There was not a single news report on TV criticizing him. It was just something that Buddy said. He wanted to support a different candidate. He nominated the candidate. He supported the candidate. And it was what it was. He talked about it beforehand. The council members have been criticized for announcing their plans. Well, Buddy Amoroso, in the business report on January 11, 2016, said that he intended to nominate Sandy Lemoyne. Not a single complaint. The same thing happened in The Advocate on January 10, 2016. Not a single complaint. But now, because council members of the Democratic side that are black are saying, not that we're going to vote against Denise Amoroso, but we're not going to vote for anybody to be appointed to this seat. I don't think that that is disrespectful. I don't think that that is wrong. I don't think that it is not moral. I think that it is a political position, and they are doing what they feel is in the best interest of all people, and they are exercising their rights the same way the late Buddy Amoroso did.
All right. Are you upset with Tara Wicker?
I think that, and this is just my opinion, and for whatever it's worth, I think that Tara Wicker is a grave disappointment to the majority Democrat and the majority black district that elected her, especially when you root this on morality. This is not an issue of morality. This is not immoral in any way. If it wasn't immoral when Buddy Amoroso did it, it's not immoral now. If it wasn't immoral when John Delgado nominated me, it's not immoral now. And the hypocrisy of the people who are now saying something when they were silent 2 years ago, the last time there was a council vacancy. It's alarming, Jim, number one, but more it speaks to the divisive nature of Baton Rouge and how there is a double standard that exists, that when black leadership attempts to stand up for black people, we are demonized, vilified, and ostracized for doing so. But when Republicans or white folks do the same thing, they are praised for it. We're watching a Republican president right now. All of these people talking about morality that are Republican. We're watching a Republican president right now snatch children from their parents, and they are justifying it by the law.
They're
saying the law says that they should not be allowed in this country. Well, the law says that a council vacancy is a council vacancy. It does not determine whether the vacancy is because of ascension to a new position or death, which is in this situation. The law simply states that if a council seat is vacant, you have 20 days as a Metro Council to appoint someone. If you don't appoint someone, it goes to the governor. And I appreciate you, Jim, for allowing the conversation to be full, because what I have seen in The Advocate and the Business Report and the WAFB, WBRZ, is a blatant attack on progressives and an attempt to go against the status quo. And all of those people are protecting tradition, not the law.
All right, and that's your interpretation. And Gary, as you can hear, is an eloquent man, publisher of the Rouge Collection. Yesterday we had Tara Wicker on, and she said it's not a black thing, not a white thing. It's just the right thing to appoint Denise Amoroso. And she said that she would want her husband to succeed her if something, heaven forbid, happened to Tara Wicker. Reverend Anderson commenting on this in an email at talk@talklouisiana.org. By the way, you can still get in, 877-217-5757, Gary Chambers with us. Reverend Anderson writes, Councilwoman Wicker's statement about her spouse is what makes this so wrong. Nobody elected anyone's spouse, period. Must get civics back in school. Your thoughts, Gary Chambers.
I'd have to agree with Reverend Anderson 100%. When I saw that Councilwoman Wicker said that she would want her husband appointed, again, this is a clear example. We don't know anything about Mike Wicker. We don't know his political policies. We don't know whether or not he would support the effort for St. George. This is a big deal. We don't know where he stands on roads and taxes. We don't know where he stands on policing. We don't know where he stands on any issue. And so to say that we should appoint someone because they're married to someone is the worst type of political appointment you can make, because the community, the people, know nothing about these individuals other than the fact that they were married to someone else. And I'm just sorry, Jim. I cannot support nominating someone to a position simply because of their relationship with someone else, not fully understanding, are they the best person to serve out this term? I personally do not believe that we should appoint anyone who is going to run for the seat, because it taints the democratic process. When Jackie Mims was appointed to the school board in the stead of Tarvel Smith being elected judge, Dr. Jackie Mims, gave a guarantee to the school board that she would not run for the seat, and the school board appointed Jackie Mims in the stead of Tarvel Smith until there was a special election.
Okay,
personally,
Gary,
I believe.
I think there's a special election next March, right?
So, it is in March.
So we're only talking about 7 months or so.
Yes, sir.
What's the big deal about putting Denise Amoroso in for such a short period? And if she wants to run, which she probably does, she'll be on the ballot in 7 months along with some other people.
I think if Denise Amoroso wants to run and serve out her husband's term, that is perfectly fine. In March, if she wants to put her name on the ballot and the people of District 8 elect Denise Amoroso, I think that that is their right to do so. I think that that is a fine thing if the citizens of District 8 want to elect her. But she was not elected. Her husband was. And I don't believe that we should. She has an advantage in that election already.
Sandy in Mid-City. Hi, Sandy. You're on the air with Gary Chambers. Sandy, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes, I was the one that Buddy Amoroso, who I met with prior to volunteering to take the Council 7 seat from Denise Marcel. So in this particular case, I tend to agree with Mr. Chambers, but I'm going to add one thing, is that when Denise Marcel went through a couple of iterations of suggesting that the council approve a couple of other folks, that didn't work real well, and she put an advisory council together. Now, and I was in favor of that. However, when we had the election, and Denise Marcel went before the board and suggested that after everyone was interviewed, including Lamont Cole, that it was a unanimous decision that Lamont take her seat. Well, that wasn't the case.
All right. Well, thank you, Sandy. And we'll spend a bit more time with Gary Chambers and also hear from Kurt Smith about presidents and baseball. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with our friend Gary Chambers of the Rouge Collection. Then it's Kurt Smith, the presidents and the pastime, with the All-Star Game coming Tuesday. And, of course, on Thursday of next week, we'll find out who succeeds the late Buddy Amoroso. Died tragically, 61 years old, riding his bicycle in St. Francisville. Just a terrible accident that should not have happened, but Buddy Amoroso's gone, and it looks like his widow will take his place. But there are some who say, hey, wait a minute, we should not allow nepotism, and even though it's tradition, to continue in our community. Patrick on Bluebonnet, you're on the air with Gary Chambers. Hi, Patrick. Please be brief.
Yeah, I agree with Gary. I don't think appointing a spouse is the way to go, but you do need to appoint someone that's representative of the district. I don't see why they don't appoint Mike Walker, who was the previous council rep. Definitely need to appoint someone that's, you know, you don't just steal the seat from the constituency. And even though Buddy Amoroso nominated someone that didn't represent that constituency, they ultimately appointed someone that represented the constituency of Denise Marcel, and she was still alive.
All right. Thank you, Patrick. Gary?
You know, Patrick used to call the other show, and we disagree a lot, but we agree on this. I'm not a fan of Mike Walker, but at least if Mike Walker were nominated, we could say we understand what Mike Walker's political positions are because there's a voting record somewhere. He's taken positions on some issues, and then there's an understanding in that situation of what we're getting. But in this situation, we don't know anything other than this person was married to the previous council member, and I just don't believe that that is a justifiable reason in a political position to appoint someone. I want to also make sure, Jim, that you understand there are black leaders within this community that have been meeting with Tyra Wicker and calling her in agreement with the four black council members, asking her to switch her vote because ultimately they feel like she is doing the wrong thing. Now, Tyra Wicker, I believe, is doing this the same reason I believe that Matt Watson is doing some of what he's doing, because they have other political ambitions, and those ambitions, they're capitalizing off of the emotion of the situation rather than just looking at the law and saying, you know what, if I didn't criticize my colleagues in 2016, if I didn't criticize the late Buddy Amoroso, I'm going to be silent and not criticize my colleagues now. And I think that people should vote for whatever they believe they want to see happen on the council, and they shouldn't be vilified if they choose to abstain. It's unfortunate that we're doing that.
Well, Gary Chambers, thank you for joining us. We'll be talking again soon. It's always good to talk with Gary Chambers of the Rouge Collection, and the council meeting is next Thursday. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you.
And we're joined now by Kurt Smith. His book is The Presidents and the Pastime. Kurt is a prolific writer. He's written 17 books. We've talked with him before, including Voices of the Game, the acclaimed chronicle of baseball radio and television broadcasting. But this one is about baseball and presidential history. And, Kurt, there is a rich history, isn't there?
Yes, there is. In fact, dating back quite literally to the founding of the country, to before there was a republic, to before George Washington was president, to when he was general, in fact, at Valley Forge in 1777-78, when he was playing baseball or rounders, that was then called the British equivalent, with an aide-de-camp for hours, wondering what came next, and then extending to a Lincoln in the early 1860s, playing town ball outside of the White House, and then bringing the game inside, playing on the corridors, using them as base paths. So this is about as far back as you can go. The tentacles of baseball and the presidency running both very deep and very, very long.
Well, next Tuesday, the spotlight will be on the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The All-Star Game is being held there, home of the Washington Nationals, and two LSU stalwarts, Aaron Nola and Alex Bregman, will be featured in that game. And it is customary for presidents often to be there and sometimes to throw out the first pitch. But the current president has refrained from upholding that tradition of presidents throwing out the first pitch on opening day. What's going on with President Trump?
Well, shame on him. And I speak as a former speechwriter to former President George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41. So this is not partisan on my behalf. But as I write and as I've spoken, this is a tradition, the president throwing out the first pitch to commemorate an All-Star game or a World Series, or particularly the opening of a baseball season. This is a rite that extends back to 1910, when William Howard Taft commenced the rite at Griffith Stadium in Washington. The irony is that Donald Trump is a great baseball fan. He grew up in New York, weaned on Maris and Mantle and the great Yankees teams of the 60s, and was a very fine player himself. so good, in fact, that the Phillies and the Red Sox, my team, both wanted to sign him in the 1960s. He could have played Major League Baseball. But as he said, rather prophetically, he said, I didn't want to make baseball money. I wanted to make real money. And he did make real money. And before becoming president, he threw out the first ball at Yankee Stadium and Fenway Park and Wrigley Field. My supposition, and it's only a supposition, is that he has failed over the first 2 years of the Washington Nationals last 2 years, his 2 years as president, throw out the opening pitch at their first game, because he is leery of being booed by the overwhelmingly Democratic city at the first game of the Nationals season, and he would be booed. But you know what? Republican presidents have been booed. Bush 41 was booed, 43 was booed, Reagan was booed. He would be booed, he would survive, and the nation would too. So that's my guess, and I think he should do it. He won't do it because he won't be back yet from the summit in Helsinki, but he should appear on opening day next year.
Yeah,
and he should be pressured to do so until he does.
Well, he's a man who, in his day, he was a good athlete. He even went so far, Kurt, I think you'll laugh at this, to say he was the best baseball player in New York City in 1962. Had a guy named
he
Mickey.
Did say so. Apparently, he's forgotten Mickey Mantle, among others.
But he is 72. he's 72 years old now, and there are those who believe that the reason he doesn't throw out the first pitch is because it is his age, and with all that weight that he's carrying around, he might not be able to make the throw 60 feet 6 inches.
He doesn't have to. Until Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, presidents didn't throw the ball out from the mound or on the field. They sat, or they stood, rather, in their presidential box, and they threw the ball 20 feet to the catcher who was standing on the field. He can certainly do that. Roosevelt did that. Kennedy did that. Johnson did that. Nixon did that. Trump could do that as well.
Okay. Well,
so that's no excuse for him either.
Yeah, and I've seen... I saw Edwin Edwards booed at a New Orleans Breakers game. That was an old USFL team, and he was part owner, and he was booed.
Yeah.
That was largely a Republican gathering. But people with means usually go to ball games. These tickets cost a lot of money now. I'm not so sure it's all Democrats in the stands when baseball teams are playing now at the highest level.
Well, being booed comes with the territory. And if he can't stand being booed by a crowd, how does he stand up to foreign leaders? So he should do it. And I'm hopeful that he will.
Well,
and enough people put the heat on him, maybe he'll see the light.
Well, getting to your book, The Presidents in the Pastime, what presidents or president were the greatest fans of baseball?
Well, I think, you know, that's a good question. And admittedly, it's an arbitrary question and answer. However, certainly Bush 41 was a great fan. He picked up a bat at age 5. He swung it, and as he once said, he knew at that moment that, quote-unquote, baseball has everything, which is a lovely and precise way of expressing baseball's lure. Bush 41 went on to become a great captain of his team at Yale, as I mentioned, and then, of course, he went on to become president of the United States. He had baseball journalists at the White House. He invited Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio, honored them with the President's Award in the Rose Garden, and just made it clear that he wished to wave a baseball-friendly flag. Richard Nixon had an endearing Walter Mitty affection for the game. He was a very bad athlete, but he was a great scholar, such a scholar, in fact, that in 1965, in between losing the presidential election in 1960 and winning it in 1968, Nixon was offered in that 1 year of 65 the position of director of the Players Union and the commissionership of baseball, both of which he declined because, as he later said, he had other plans, which was, of course, to become president. But Nixon offered and hosted an all-star gala in 1969 to commemorate baseball's centennial. Hank Aaron said he knew more about baseball than most of the officials in the game. And he once had a wonderful synopsis of Casey Stengel, who, of course, invented the convoluted language Stengelese. Nixon said the essence of diplomacy is to confuse the opposition. Casey always knew what he was talking about. The opposition never knew what he was talking about. Nixon said if he had to do over again, he would have named Casey Stengel Secretary of State. I mean, the very thought staggers the imagination.
Well, thank you, Kurt.
So those two, I would say, probably lead the list.
And congratulations on the president and the pastime. It's been a pleasure. And we'll be back Monday, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill, I'm Jim Inkster. And hope you have a great weekend. Glad you're listening to 89.3 WRKF. A reminder that Tuesday of next week, it is the All-Star Game, and it is possible that Aaron Nola, who has a record of 12-2, he is scheduled to start tomorrow night. He could be the starter for the National League.